It is a privilege to represent Mr. Jones, and it is unfortunate that Mr. Jones did not get the counsel of his choice, even though he was prepared to retain that counsel.
But the statutory issue, the 19.2, 159.1 issue,
yes, sir.
Isn't that waived by the guilty plea? Because it seems that that's what we said in Commons, and whether we agree with it or don't agree with it, we're bound by Commons.
Judge, the distinction here is both the recency of the issues that arise between with the lawyer-client relationship, as well as the factor that he could not voluntarily enter a plea because he did not have all of his legal options available to him when the court denied his motion for the counsel that he was entitled to.
He never made a motion to withdraw his guilty plea, did he?
He did not, Your Honor. Not this guilty plea. No, Your Honor, he did not.
Does that affect our ability to hear the matter?
I don't think so, and I think that's because, first of all, it's an issue that is not a constitutional issue as far as the assignment of error. However, the statute in which we are asking the court to interpret is a statute that is designed to preserve a constitutional issue. And so,
But the problem is, how is that any different than the situation in Cobbins where the guilty plea wiped it all clean?
Well, I think in this case, Your Honor, the facts demonstrate that Mr. Jones was not receiving adequate assistance.
Well, that's an ineffective assistance claim, and we can't do that here.
I understand that on a direct appeal, ineffective assistance is not acceptable. However, as the Commonwealth even points out in their brief, the refusal of the trial court to grant a continuance for new counsel or to appoint new counsel must also prejudice the defendant. And the most common and reasonable way that that would prejudice the defendant is to be in a lawyer-client relationship that is ineffective. I'm not raising ineffective assistance as an assignment of error. I'm raising it as a fulfillment of the second prong that requires prejudice to the defendant.
If we can reach the statutory issue.
Yes, sir.
Given the number of counsel changes and how they seem to come about.
Yes, sir.
Why couldn't a reasonable trial judge believe this was a continuation of a tactic by your client to do this at every time and then find that no continuance could ever be reasonable?
Yes, sir. First of all, I think that the text of the statute solves that problem. The protection that we are arguing exists under the statute is that when counsel is appointed and then retained, that is when the accused has the right to the continuance and has the right to for the court to accept that request.
That's a reasonable continuance.
Why yes,
can't
sir.
The court say, given the number of continuances and the number of delays already that have been caused, I think, light most favorable to the Commonwealth, by the defendant's conduct and his conduct with his attorneys, that no continuance could ever be reasonable in this circumstance?
Yes, sir. Judge, first, the trial court didn't make sufficient inquiry into the details of the continuance. The trial court simply asked Mr. Haley, are you ready to go today? And so the trial court lacked sufficient basis to decide whether the continuance itself would be reasonable. Our position is that the statute does not say it must be a reasonable request. It assumes under the circumstances in the first sentence that the request is going to be reasonable. It then leaves it to the trial judge to evaluate whether the length of the continuance is reasonable.
He didn't come in with a new lawyer who he said, I have retained to represent me, did he? He came in with somebody who said, I might be being hired by the family to represent him.
Yes, Judge, and I think that under a lot of circumstances that would be deficient. However, given how recent some very serious breaches of the lawyer-client relationship had happened, Mr. Weston had filed a motion to withdraw without consulting with Mr. Jones mere days earlier. And so our position would be that for Mr. Haley to come in, even in the situation that he was very strong demonstration that that's where we were going, that that's what we were doing. Given the short amount of time, the lack of resources that the court found over and over again that Mr. Jones lacked, as well as the fact he was incarcerated. All of those things show that what he did accomplish was rather remarkable. And no judge needs to be told that you may do something that you find reasonable. And that's the interpretation that the Commonwealth wants this court to arrive at, is that shall is more like may, and the continuance has to be reasonably asked for and a reasonable length. It moots the language. It makes it...
Well, if it has to be a reasonable continuance, you don't dispute it deals with length, do you?
No, I don't. I think that...
Could under these circumstances, could there be so many disruptions and continuances leading up to that the court believes that a reasonable continuance could not be of any length?
No,
that,
Judge.
That we have to go forward today regardless.
Because once you look at the statute and you see that a continuance shall be granted, that means that what has happened before can't affect whether the length Mr. Haley would have asked for is reasonable.
Forgive me if I'm interrupting you. I'm sorry. But
yes, ma'am.
Would it be different if it said the court shall grant a reasonable continuance as opposed to reasonable continuance, or do you think that's a distinction without a difference? That would be a stronger case for you, wouldn't it?
Because it
says it has to grant a continuance and has reasonable modifying continuance.
Yes, ma'am. I do think it's stronger, but I don't think it's necessary because, as I stated in my brief, the grammar, which hasn't been addressed by this court, reasonable only modifies continuance. Shall modifies the verb grant. And so if shall means may, then there's no reason for the continuance to be modified by the word reasonable.
Couldn't you say you shall grant reasonable continuance, with the implication being you don't have to grant unreasonable continuance?
Yes, but the characteristics of a continuance is essentially length, not whether it exists at all. The existence of the continuance at all would be fall under the shall grant, because by granting, you create a continuance. Now we're modifying what that continuance is by putting reasonability. In the situation that Judge Russell brought up, I would argue that what you look at that point is whether the length of time is reasonable in terms of whether he can have effective assistance of counsel with that period of time. Mr. Haley can't get ready faster just because Mr. Jones had prior attorneys. I'd also like to bring to the court's attention that the first change was from the public defender's office to private counsel. And that's a fairly common when clients have that opportunity. There's no delay or negative inference to do that. And then that Mr. Hill goes to Mr. Padgett. Mr. Padgett is relieved over Mr. Jones' objection. So here we have Mr. Jones not wanting his counsel to be changed. And so I'd ask the court not to count against him the change to private counsel, and then again the change that he objected to. The court should not find is against Mr. Jones.
Was there any evidence proffered as to how the defendant was no longer indigent, how he could possibly retain counsel when in the past he couldn't?
No, Judge, and that is evidence of both the fact that the attorney-client relationship had degraded so much he wasn't receiving effective assistance, as well as the argument that the court did not make sufficient inquiry
but
to make the
ruling. But there's nothing in the record, then, to convince the judge that he was, in fact, able to retain counsel.
I think that a private attorney taking time out of his day to come to the court and represent to the court that they would like the opportunity to represent someone, the court can infer from that attorney has done due diligence.
But the attorney said he had not been retained, but that he would sign on as counsel of record if they grant him a continuance.
Yes, sir. And the court has made rulings in the past that once that attorney does that, then he's on the case. And if he must have been confident enough in Mr. Jones' ability to pay to put himself on that hook.
I've, I've heard a lot of Mr. Green motions in my time.
Yes, sir.
My witness, Mr. Green, hasn't appeared yet.
Yes, sir. And from my perspective, I hope that they're always granted. But as a matter of law, I know they're not. I would ask to reserve.
But the statute says that in the event the defendant undergoes a change of circumstances so that he's no longer indigent, couldn't the court in this case, based on the lack of any proof that he was no longer indigent, disbelieve him, his ability, or not accept his ability to retain counsel and see it as a delaying tactic?
Not under the facts that were presented to the court in this case. And if the court will look through the record at previous hearings, Mr. Jones was not prepared to argue the legal nuances because he had a bad relationship with the attorney. The judge didn't really walk him through the legal nuances, in part because that's not the judge's job, but it also created a defective record, a deficient record, to make those decisions. And so, at minimum, this court should remand the case for the court to make those determinations that it didn't make, because on the facts, whatever the interpretation of a reasonable continuance, the judge did not make enough findings about the nature and character of those continuance. It was simply a reaction to the fact that Mr. Jones had prior counsel without taking into consideration, for example, the most significant reasons had only happened a few days earlier, as well as the significance of an attorney standing there putting himself on the hook. I ask to reserve the remainder. Okay.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Lauren Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth would submit that this case is exactly on point with Cobbins, that the defendant waived all appellate issues that were non-jurisdictional when he entered his no-contest pleas. Actually, differently, in Cobbins, that defendant did move to vacate his pleas and did have an assignment of error that his pleas were involuntary, and once this court determined that they were not, then the court determined that all other issues were waived, and the court could not reach the issue regarding 19.2.159.1b. Therefore, following Cobbins, Clausen, Savino, and Mason, all cited in my brief, this court cannot reach those issues because they have been waived. The defendant also, in the guilty plea colloquy, acknowledged that he understood he was waiving all those rights. The trial court specifically asked him, do you understand you're waiving all appellate rights except those jurisdictional, or if I impose a sentence greater than law? And the defendant affirmed he understood that. I'd be happy to address the merits if this court wishes. I can briefly, both assignments of error are abuse of discretion standard. I think it's clear based on the totality of the record here that the defendant was difficult, that he never actually presented a true conflict of interest or reason that his counsel was mandated to withdraw. The trial court did a good job of putting on the record that there was no actual conflict of interest. There was no ethical issue with counsel not putting on the so-called alibi defense, and multiple other issues that the trial court hashed out both on the record with the defendant and his counsel. Turning to the 19.2.159.1b, there is nothing on the record to indicate that the defendant's change of circumstances allowed him to retain counsel. This new counsel, Haley, had not been retained, appeared to be in court that day. It's unclear why, and yes, he did say he would be interested in being retained, but there's just simply no record to support that the statute should apply to the defendant at all. He also made a number of 518 arguments on brief, again, that the defendant can now not argue that his pleas were involuntary. And also, all the ineffective allegations are, as this court has already noted, not properly before this court.
What would the defendant have had to do to preserve this objection?
The objection?
That he was entitled to counsel of his own choosing. Would he have had to go to trial?
Yes, Your Honor. To not wait, but absolutely, Your Honor.
I'm trying to think that through. He's got an attorney that he doesn't like and can't get along with. it just it seems a little unfair to him to force him to go to trial, perhaps even a jury trial, in order to appeal.
Well, Your Honor, no one's forcing him to either go to trial or to take a plea. That's why there's a extensive guilty plea colloquy that is conducted by the trial court.
I can't think it through.
If the new retained counsel had shown up and said, I am retained, would that be different?
I think that would be different if he had been retained and he had, then essentially there would also be something on the record that showed that he had been able to come up with money. I also noted in brief that there, I think the statute doesn't specifically say, it says it's a change in the defendant's circumstances. That doesn't necessarily mean he can show his family had money. And I know that.
To respond to Judge, or follow up on Judge Petty's question, if the new retained counsel had filed a motion to withdraw his plea of guilty before sentencing, would that have been one possible way to address the issue?
Absolutely, Your Honor. We would be in a posture similar to what Cobbins was, and this court would then have been able to review whether or not the plea was involuntary, knowing involuntary.
We'd probably be able to withdraw it. It would be much easier than if it was post-sentencing.
Well, certainly, and then if this court found that the plea was involuntary and unknowing based on that situation, then he would get the outcome that was not available in Collins because... Or Cobbins, I apologize. But so yes, there are a couple. There are many avenues. Unfortunately, when you plead no contest or you plead no guilty, you are waiving your appellate issues, other than those jurisdictional. And the defendant was made aware of this. So to preserve it, he would. I would not agree with the characterization that he'd be forced to go to trial. But going to trial is how you preserve your appellate issues. And if there are no further questions. The Commonwealth would ask that you affirm the trial court's decision. Thank you.
Judge, I would argue that there's a distinction between I don't want to go to trial because I think I'm going to lose, and I don't want to go to trial because I think he's going to lose. And I think that that is a distinction that is fair to draw, especially in this case, especially given the time crunch. I think that's a critical distinction between this case and all other cases, both in his ability to formulate a knowing and voluntary decision. It was a huge decision that he experienced, and it was a very bad experience in this whole process. And so he's acutely aware of how terrible the experience could be if he went to trial. And so I adamantly say that he was forced to go to trial if he did not plead no contest. And so with those two options, is to go to trial and preserve my appellate issues, if he even understood that, given the record showing his lack of understanding of a lot of legal issues, it's impossible to say that he could have really made that decision in the circumstance that he was in, given especially given the time frame, but also given the nature of his relationship with his court-appointed attorney. I also would argue that the plea colloquy is often just answered in the way that the client knows that it needs to go in order to get the outcome. And I know that doesn't change anything. You know, we're all certainly bound to the words that we choose. But I don't think that his answers show that he was, in fact, in a position to adequately evaluate his circumstances and to knowing and voluntarily make those decisions given the issues with counsel that are present. And I think that's a very narrow exception and a very narrow distinction for the general principle that that pleading no contest does waive appellate rights. And it would almost be as if we were to learn that he didn't speak English. My first jury trial ended a mistrial because one of the jurors didn't speak English and just gave the answer everybody else gave, because that's what I would do if I didn't speak the language. And so he didn't speak the language. Mr. Jones did not speak the language of the room that he was in. He didn't speak the language of the law, and his analogous interpreter wasn't fulfilling the role, I was quite surprised that as much as Mr. Weston wanted to be relieved, that Mr. Jones wasn't more prepared to present the evidence that would have been necessary. I do ask that this court find that Mr. Jones' convictions were inappropriate and that this court reverse the trial court in convicting Mr. Jones.
Thank you very much for your argument. Your Greek counsel and then this panel will be concluded.